regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federal Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. This afternoon, we are pleased to bring you a great conversation on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, featuring Ashley Baker, who is the Director of Public Policy at the Committee for Justice, and Nathan Leamer, who is Vice President of Public Affairs at Targeted Victory. If our audience would like to learn more about each of our speakers and their work, you can visit regproject.org, regproject.org, where we have their full bios. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Ashley to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we will go to audience Q&A, so please be thinking of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you all for joining us. Ashley, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Nathan. So as of today, three provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, have expired. The deadline was on Sunday the 15th. And this afternoon, the Senate has a cloture vote at 5:30 p.m. on moving forward with a House bill that was passed on Wednesday, which I'll kind of get into the details about here in a minute. So there's another elephant in the room, too, which is that the FISA reauthorization stands in the way of a coronavirus bill, and the Senate can't really move forward with the coronavirus bill until they do something on the FISA issue. And while the coronavirus outbreak is a national emergency and should be, a top priority for Congress, it's also more of a reason to be on the lookout for bad legislation, because that's when, bad legislation tends to happen during times of crises. But that's not necessarily to absolve Congress from blame. They've known about this deadline since December, and they've waited until, the 11th hour, and that there was, a global pandemic. So that's far less than ideal. So I'm going to cover the current debate over FISA and the role of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or known as FISC, or the FISA courts. And then later, Nathan's going to go over Section 215 and discuss some of the more technical provisions that are up for renewal here, and also kind of the political context and the events over the years that have led us to where we are today, because it's kind of a complex history. So to go over the three provisions that are up for reauthorization, so first, there's Section 215, as I just mentioned, and Section 215 permits the FBI to obtain orders to collect business records, such as call detail records, is one thing it can collect that can, that can pertain to a broad range of records. The second one is the roving wiretap provision, is what it's called, and that permits surveillance on subjects even after they've changed phones or they've changed devices from one cell phone to another, from different types of devices. And the third is called the lone wolf provision, and that permits monitoring subjects who don't have ties to international terrorist organizations. So they could have ties to domestic terrorist organizations, which would fall under something in another law. Or no ties whatsoever, and that provision permits that. So a compromise bill, so to speak, passed the House last Wednesday by a 278-136 vote. And then after that, Majority Leader McConnell canceled Senate recess in order to consider the coronavirus bill, but we have to consider the FISA renewal first. And so there are a couple of possibilities as to how this will play out over the next few hours or next few days or months, depending on how things go. And the first possibility is the Senate could just quickly pass the House bill. There's a lot of opposition to that, and Trump's actually said or tweeted that he will veto that. But that is one possibility, that they see the coronavirus bill as being more urgent and just pass this. Another possibility is they could just let these measures lapse for a while. That's far less than ideal. And also Congress could grant an extension of the provisions and then reconsider the reauthorization in coming months. That might be, you know, a better option. And then, you know, procedurally, they could skip ahead to the coronavirus bill, but then that would take the permission of every senator. So the chances of that happening are relatively slim. But, you know, if this bill is passed, Trump might very well veto, as he's said on Twitter, and as several senators have urged him to do, Senators Paul and Senator Lee. So, you know, it could be pretty temporary. Trump, kind of his motivation for wanting to veto this bill is more so the Carter Page incident in his the surveillance of his 2016 campaign. Which is interesting because reforming some of these provisions might not have ever happened, you know, prevented that from happening. That's not to say that they don't need to be reformed. But, you know, in that incident, they were already doing something that was illegal. So, you know, I think, you know, they would just be doing something else. They would be violating a slightly different law. This wouldn't necessarily be a deterrent to behavior that's already illegal. However, it could make it a little bit more difficult to misrepresent things to the courts is one hoop here. So what's in the bill is the bill would extend these three provisions that I just discussed through 2023, so three more years. And the first thing that it would do is it would expand criminal penalties for officials who make false representations to the court or to FISC. And that raises the criminal penalty from 5 to 8 years for a prison sentence for engaging in electronic surveillance without following the proper procedures. The bill would also make clear that the government cannot use business records in order to collect information that goes back to Section 215, such as cell phone location data, that in a criminal investigation requires a search warrant, which has a higher legal standard. Or the other provisions of the bill are really a lot more cosmetic and don't necessarily do quite as much, I would say. The bill would outlaw the disclosure of the existence of an application or classified information contained in it, as well as knowingly making a false declaration before the FISA court. These moves would be more symbolic, I think, than anything, because these things are already illegal. I think it's, you know, reiterating what the law already says, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's not exactly a proactive measure. And the part of the bill that I would like to focus on more so is that it would expand the role of the FISA judges. And I think that's, you know, kind of pretty significant. So these FISA judges normally only hear from the government when deciding whether to grant a surveillance application. Under the bill would be able to appoint an outsider to critique the government's position and advocate for the target of a FISA application. And currently, the judges are supposed to only do this when interpreting what is called a novel and significant question of surveillance law. I think that's probably the more significant part of the bill. So in theory, advocates would find and critique, you know, abuses found in, you know, for example, the Carter Page application. But in practice, they might just, you know, dilute accountability even further. And it creates, you know, just another layer of bureaucracy. There's no guarantee that it would stop political abuse. And it might also obstruct, you know, legitimate FISA warrants. So we don't know necessarily how that would play out. And it does give a lot more power to these FISA judges. And under the bill, FISC would also be directed to consider appointing a government critic when an application presents exceptional concerns, it says, about protecting the First Amendment rights of a surveillance subject. So the bigger issue that we're dealing here with FISC is that Congress has delegated its oversight role to the judiciary. When, you know, we saw the passage of the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act that departed from the original warrant model that pre-existed there. And it gave judges the responsibility to also approve surveillance authorities that are untethered from, you know, a specific target. So these applications don't necessarily pertain to one specific person. It gives the FISA judges a lot more authority. There's one common stat that's that cited that 100% of warrants are granted by FISA judges. That's not entirely accurate. It's a bit more complex than that. Just one thing that I wanted to clear up. So the intelligence officials do engage in dialogue with DISC about warrant applications. These are classified, and it's, you know, an ex parte procedure. Only the government officials and the judge are present. So, you know, behind the scenes, kind of what happens is that if the court's uncomfortable with the, you know, probable cause showing that isn't, you know, so strong, the government often either, you know, voluntarily withdraws the warrant application for that target, or in another scenario, the judge will inform the government officials what the application is kind of lacking and say, okay, come back and here's how you meet the standards. And also the judges aren't really prone to denying these applications, I think, because of course they would defer to the intelligence experts because, you know, as judges, this is just not their, not their level of expertise. And that, so that brings up another issue, is that these judges aren't competent to oversee intelligence operations and make calls related to national security. This isn't their role. It's not a judicial exercise. And congressional oversight would actually be significantly more effective than the Fifth System. The judiciary is not institutionally competent, it said, to oversee these intelligence operations. Also, since national security is a duty of the executive branch, not the judiciary, it's like it's natural that they would defer to these intelligence officials, which makes this really even more out of place than it already is. I think it was Bork who said in the 1970s that presidents were responsible to voters if they abused spying power. So all this is, you know, a duty and accountability go to the executive branch and not the judiciary here. And I think there's also, you know, a major separation of powers problem here, which I can't really get into today. That would take a little bit longer than we have allocated on this call here. But overall, I would say just these problems with FISA are a lot more systemic than, you know, what Congress is kind of debating now, and the system of congressional oversight and accountability, instead of having these Article III judges who are essentially embedded in the executive branch, would be more ideal. Ideally, we would just throw out FISA and start over, but that's asking for a lot, especially in only a couple of hours here. But like I said, the problem is that Congress has known about this since December, and they waited until the 11th hour. And, you know, there's a possibility for some comprehensive reform here, but what we're left with is not necessarily that. Nathan, if you'd like to kind of get into some of those specific provisions.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. Actually, it was a really good overview of kind of the lay of the land with the USA Freedom Act Reauthorization Act. For a little background, it has what I'm watching today and over the past few weeks is really a replay of a lot of the back and forth and political machinations we've seen over surveillance reform over the past several years. You know, one of the things that happens is, instead of having the robust debate and discussion in the congressional committees, where we see a last minute, we must pass this or the sky is falling rhetoric. And I think that's a really problematic way to think about it, particularly as Ashley has alluded, and Wall Street Journal and New York Times and others have reported on. There have been a lot of examples of abuse of these programs, of lack of transparency and accountability, and opportunities for whole-scale reform that have come to light over the past several years. And, you know, Congress has a responsibility and a duty to take a real serious look at that and measure a balanced approach between security and national and security and civil liberties, and trying to find a way to improve the way our court systems work and the FISC works, and the way that these programs may be used to collect innocent Americans' information. Now, for what it's worth, in my opinion, the situation we are in now over this reauthorization is much better than we were back in 2013 when Edward Snowden originally made a lot of these revelations, and there was a real dearth of knowledge from many people on Capitol Hill. In fact, the author of the Patriot Act, Jim Sensenbrenner, going on the record saying if he had known this is how this program was going to be used, he wouldn't have authored it. And I think that's, that serves as a really fascinating background to see how things have changed. And in 2015, we saw the people come together from both the left and the right, and from the national security side of things to the civil liberty side of things, to say, hey, here's a balanced approach that moves forward to rein in a number of these metadata collection programs and really ratchet up the oversight and accountability to the court systems that are processing this in a way that brings everyone together. And I think that's a really helpful model that we could move forward. And I think the way that the USA Freedom Act has used sunset to allow Congress, to prompt Congress and the public to have a conversation about what's going on is helpful. And allows us to say, hey, what works, what doesn't work, and look at either systematic failures or things that are targeted in their approach. And so for me, as a privacy advocate who's worked on the USA Freedom Act and also worked on the Amash Amendment back in 2013 with the metadata collection program, I feel better about where we are compared to where we were several years ago, but there is a long way to go. And I think the process concerns that have been raised by, you know, Congressman Zoe Lofgren and others are really worth considering. And Mike Lee has written about this and discussed this. And I think it's worth getting into, and hopefully we'll be able to do that on this call a little bit more. Another part that I wanted to highlight is just something that I've noticed among privacy advocates in the surveillance space, and something that I would encourage you know, people who care about this or care about privacy to think about how their advocacy works. Many times I've noticed we pit an all or nothing approach to the legislative process or to how things should work. And I think that does a disservice to the American people. It does a disservice to those who want to rein in government surveillance. Look, we have a national security apparatus that is huge, that involves multiple agencies, that involves multiple courts. And whilst maybe unpopular in some ways and maybe questionable how effective they are, it is a huge part of our infrastructure and the way our country works. And so one of the things that I think I've found frustrating is when you pit either we must repeal all of the surveillance states or keep it as is in perpetuity. And I think one of the things this USA Freedom Act in 2015 did a really good job of was establishing, again, that balanced approach, and that people from both sides could latch on to that and say, you know what, let's not pick an either or, let's find this middle road. And I know that doesn't leave everyone satisfied either on both the civil liberty side or the national security side, but I do think that allows policymakers and the public to move the ball in the right manner towards a place where there's more accountability, more transparency, more oversight, more in line with our Fourth Amendment protections that have been given to us, and also dealing with the realities of the challenges that terrorism and concerns about communications present to national security and law enforcement. And so I think it's really frustrating that in late February there was a hearing in which both scheduled and a judiciary hearing in which they were looking at this legislation. And instead of following through with that hearing and allowing an open dialogue and open conversations, there was what appeared to be relatively a behind closed doors effort to create the one path that they're going to accept, and that was to be accepted by leadership, and then kind of bulldozing that approach without kind of open for debate and discussion. And I think Mike Lee has written extensively about that. There's actually a letter that was sent out by the ACLU and FreedomWorks, a kind of bipartisan group of privacy advocates, basically kind of raising questions about maybe areas where this latest reform could be changed and improved in their eyes. And also you're seeing people from the other side of the aisle having a different perspective as well. And so with that in mind, I figured I'd go over, you know, without boring you too much, without going over all the each section, I actually found, just so you know, Lawfare blog had a piece put out by Margaret Taylor and Shara Boutash that goes into H.R. 6172, looking at the actual section-by-section breakdown. And I found that really helpful. Without going through every single section within that, which could get a little boring, Ashley, no, my apologies, I figured I'd just do the top-line summary Just to kind of reiterate kind of what this legislation says. So again, the bill would extend three aspiring tools, like the FBI's ability to get the FISA court's orders for business records deemed relevant to a national security investigation, while ending legal authority for some of the dysfunctional and defunct NSA system that had allowed counterterrorism analysts to swiftly access logs of American phone calls. The bill also expands the FISA judges who normally hear only from the government when deciding whether its grant surveillance application should appoint an outsider to critique the government's position in amici, which, by the way, is a provision that was very important in the USA Freedom Act, and there's a number of different ideas out there for how that maybe could be improved to overall enhance accountability. The FISA court will also be directed to consider appointing government critique when application presents exceptional concerns about protecting the First Amendment rights of a surveillance subject. In fact, actually, there's an amendment proposal that FreedomWorks and ACLU specifically discussed that I thought was very interesting about basically that this could create some problems because while expanding the provision is a good idea, the bill fails to create, in their mind, a presumption that an amicus be appointed in other cases raising targeting U.S. persons or raising constitutional concerns, does not provide amici with access to sufficient information to allow them to intervene in cases where there are pronounced concerns, and fails to ensure that the amici are not denied access to necessary materials. And so while some could say, hey, this moves us in the right direction, another point of view could say that it doesn't go far enough to actually deal with maybe concerns similar, not really, not exactly the same as the Carter Page situation. Let me see here. There's other points that I wanted to highlight. The bill would not make any change that many civil liberties and privacy advocates have advocated, which would let defense lawyers read FISA applications if their clients are prosecuted on the basis of evidence derived from such wiretaps or searches, as defense lawyers are permitted to do in ordinary criminal cases. Obviously, I am not a lawyer. I play one on social media. You guys at the Federal Society know more about this than I would. But, you know, I do think that there's a really interesting question that a number of privacy advocates have raised about what information those on the in defense side have to adjudicating what information is out there and knowing what's out there to go forward. However, as Ashley alluded, the bill does expand criminal penalties issues surrounding misuse of FISA, raising from 5 to 8 years the prison sentence for engaging in electronic surveillance without following procedures. The bill would also outlaw disclosure of the existence of application or classified information contained in it, as well as knowingly making false declarations before FISA court. The move would be more symbolic than substantive because those were already legal, and I had something Ashley alluded to. And it also would make clear the government cannot use a business records order to collect information like cell phone location data that in criminal investigation requires a search warrant, which has a higher legal standard. And so one of the things that I actually thought was pretty interesting was yes, while location data has been exited out of that, it fails to deal with other types of sensitive records, including web browsing or search history. And while there have been thoughtful proposals from members of both parties to exclude these and other sensitive types of sensitive information, those type of proposals or language were not included in this version that's being voted in the Senate. One final word, kind of before I guess I open it up from my end for questions or back and forth with Ashley, that I found was very interesting is I've been in conversations with both reporters and also lobbyists on this issue over the past several hours. And to be honest, my understanding is that the whip count for cloture, which needs 60 votes, is very, very much up in the air. As Ashley mentioned, there is a coronavirus COVID-19 package that is of dire interest to the public, and how this FISA reauthorization does kind of stand in its way, and so that may sway people one way or the other. But you know, according to the reports that I've heard, and the scuttlebutt has been that you know they're going to have a hard time getting 60 votes they need to pass cloture, which really puts people in a bind. Because again, there isn't a middle path approach. It's either all or nothing, and that all or nothing approach it is frustrating, I think, for a lot of people on the outside because they're unable to have that real needed conversation that a lot of the public feels that they need or deserve. So that is something that I'll be following over the next several hours. I'm sure a number of you will as well. It will be interesting to see how this shakes out. But glad we're having this conversation and glad to be part of it. So thanks again for having me.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you on the all or nothing approach, and that's something that you see within the privacy advocates, you know, across the board, with other legislation as well. You know, facial recognition, for example, they, you know, just want to ban it all. There's no in between. And then we saw this in the debate too over the Section 702 sunset back in 2015-2016. And one of the reasons why that effort essentially failed is, you know, we had one side saying we really need this as a matter of national security, and then privacy advocates saying sunset or nothing. Let's not, you know, consider amending it. And I think, I'm someone who kind of falls in the middle between the two. I think we do need some of these provisions for national security, and they are important. They have stopped terrorist attacks. But, you know, considering specific nuance policies and amendments, I think, is really important here, instead of just, you know, engaging in very loud advocacy and pushing for, you know, ideals about privacy that at the end of the day are pretty unrealistic, to, you know, let the provision sunset or whatever the case may be, depending on what we're considering. But I do think, and I also agreed with Nathan, by the way, on the hearing in February behind the scenes, there's been a lot of, especially on tech issues, a lot of lawmakers deciding their collective position on something and then pushing that out there before there's actually a public hearing or any sort of public debate. I feel like there's just not robust debate around this issue. But I do think, like I was talking about earlier, is that the larger issue that's kind of being ignored here is, do we want to expand the role of FISA judges? I think that's a bigger issue, and it's a constitutional issue as well. And do we want to put judges in charge of our national security decisions? I think that's kind of a real problem, and that's also more of a political exercise than a judicial one. So, you know, ideally we would just reform the FISA courts or get rid of this altogether, but that's, you know, living in a more ideal all or nothing world too.
Yeah, hi. It's a really good point that you bring up, and something that it is, I think, concerning when this bill doesn't enable more oversight and transparency into the process, whether it's a presumption that an amicus be appointed in other cases beyond just those that are exceptional or novel and significant. I think it's a missed opportunity. I think it speaks to, again, an unwillingness to have a deeper conversation in Capitol Hill about some of these really touchy issues, as we've seen with the EARN Act, and other conversations about encryption, or conversations in other tech issue, tech-related conversations. I think there's just been a missed opportunity for open dialogue and open conversations and a real honest appraisal of what is or what is not going on to the American public. In fact, you know, I read an interesting article earlier from Just Security writing interestingly about how, you know, the people that we're trying to target through these programs are using different types of communication than they were before, than they were 5, 10, or 15 years ago, how technology has changed, and how that should raise real questions for those of us who are privacy, who care about privacy and are advocates in that space, or and also those who are wanting to continue these programs, to say, well, are they effective? Are they the most effective as they currently are structured? Or is there another way of looking at it? And, you know, I think that there's a real opportunity that we're just missing by rushing the conversation.
I would push back a little bit about what you said about having, you know, outside MEC and outside advocates. I think there's a good possibility, actually, that this, you know, could make things worse, and said, you know, it would probably stall a lot of legitimate FISA warrants as well, instead of, maybe it wouldn't catch, you know, necessarily these politically motivated issues or, you know, warrants that didn't establish the appropriate standards. But I feel like, you know, we would be in a situation where we'd have advocates critiquing the government in every single case. Because that's, you know, what privacy advocates do. But I do think it would just create another level of bureaucracy. I mean, I like the idea of it. I just wonder, you know, how that could be kind of more narrow in a way that, you know, could be a lot more efficient.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I think if I remember right, there are a number of proposals that have been outlined in this space, both by members in the Republican Party, Democratic Party, about kind of how you would curtail that. Also, how that could play into the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board and kind of what their role should be and how it goes in what the proper structure should be. Again, I think that's an area of debate and discussion. And I think that, finding, these words matter, changing the language from what it was to exceptional changes things a little bit. But is there a way to change the language even more that could find a more balanced idea? But, your point is well taken. It does raise questions about what has happened or what has not happened. But it's also an interesting point that, again, even with these programs as structured, if I remember right, I think one lead has been found through this whole process. And that same lead was also used. There were other authorities that were also used to find that same lead. And so it does make you wonder, again, going back to the overall question about the efficacy of this program as structured, and maybe, maybe hasn't been effective as structured. And that has been without the mass oversight that have potentially the bureaucratic concerns that you're raising. But again, it is a fair discussion point. And that's what Capitol Hill should be about, having that dialogue. Instead, unfortunately, we are not having that. From what I understand, just a little pushback as well, from what I understand, a number of advocates, particularly Mike Lee and Rand Paul, and I think also I see a letter here written by Zoe Lofgren and Representative Warren Davidson in the House, basically asking for Senate to pass a clean reauthorization of the Freedom Act with no changes for 45 days to give them more time to have a detailed conversation. Now, I'm sure if that happened 43 days from now, you would have a last-minute introduction of basically the same bill introduced and told we got to pass it or it's going to be expired. But, maybe in that 45 days there could be a hearing. Maybe there could be a conversation about what is or what is not the right path forward.
Yeah, I think that's probably, the best option moving forward, especially given the fact that could be passed pretty quickly and Congress could then move on to the coronavirus bill, which is more immediately urgent.
And also just to jump on that, I mean, they've already passed this, and I think it was a 90-day delay as well. I mean, they passed a clean reauthorization in December because they didn't feel like addressing the real issues brought up in December. So, there's always something getting in the way of doing this. Now, I don't know how to run the schedule in the House or the Senate, but there's always things popping up. Some are viruses you don't expect, and others, you create your own self. But it is a very interesting question about if they've already passed the 90 days, what would 40 to 5 days really be a problem for to be able to actually address these underlying issues that so many privacy advocates on both the left and right have brought up?
Yeah, I think we should probably turn it over to questions now.
Great. This is Nate. I think it's been an excellent overview. Let's transition to audience questions to see what our callers have to ask our speakers today. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt. Please state your name and affiliation and then ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. While we're waiting for folks to line up for the queue, a reminder that you can consult our full schedule of upcoming RTP calls on our website, regproject.org. And we do have a call. Our next call for RTP is on this Wednesday, the 18th at 12 p.m. We'll be hosting a call on certificate of need laws and healthcare access. That call will feature Christina Sandifer, who is the executive vice president at the Goldwater Institute, and Josh Windham, who is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. Again, if you'd like to enter the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign. At this point, we don't have any. The question line is wide open. Ashley, Nathan, are there other points you'd like to add to what you've shared so far?
Yeah, I'd say this. I mean, so, I think even on our pre-call, Ashley, Nate, and I were having a joke about you know, conversations about what the realities of the coronavirus will lead in terms of what authorities will be enacted at the federal and state level. And I think that, you know, this issue falls right in line with that conversation about what are the right limits and what is the right approach going forward in the way that government uses its authorities, both for public safety or national security or public health. And so, you know, I think today with the vote at 5:30 really does open us to a conversation that I think is we desperately need in this country about what the right balance for that is and what the lines should be or not be. And I'm really glad that the Federalist Society is leading that conversation. So thanks for having me on it.
Oh, it's certainly our pleasure. It looks like we have our first caller of the day. If you'd like to get in line behind him or her, please enter star then the pound sign on your telephone. Let's go to the first question.
Hey there, it's Carter Page calling. I have a your point about, you know, there's always something getting in the way of getting this done. I'm curious, one of the big issues that the Republicans in both houses have had is the complete lies coming out of DOJ. I mean, going back throughout this, mm-hmm. the initial debacle which started this to begin with, and which has a implication of just zero credibility for the organization. And I know there's maybe good people on top now, but, you know, I think as the president noted yesterday, with General Flynn losing documents in terms of his court case, et cetera, you know, peripherally related to this as well. And what Congressman Devin Nunes told Maria Bartiromo yesterday about, you know, not wanting to do anything until we get some data and information. I'm just curious of your thoughts as to, you know, I mean, a lot of these debates and topics you're talking about remain somewhat theoretical when there's just a complete lack of credibility and a lack of truth coming out of these organizations to begin with. So I'm just curious sort of from a more of a macro perspective, you know, your sense of how those things are trending, given the fact, you know, as you say, nothing is getting done and we're kind of in the same place we were many months ago.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I, you know, I wish I had a better answer to this question. I mean, you alluded to more data. That would be great. But, you know, the issue of trust is really a huge problem right now. You know, when they lose that credibility, it's really hard to gain that back. And at the same time, you know, we need, you know, one of these programs, you know, in place for national security purposes. So we can't assume that everyone is going to abuse it either. So, you know, just because we have the right people in power, so to speak, doesn't mean that it will, you know, remain that way. So I don't really, Nathan, do you have a better answer to that?
No, I think that's what that's what I think was frustrating for me in with the sunset actually happening is the way the sunset's supposed to happen is that we should, you know, take it as an opportunity to take our temperature and realize, you know, what are the underlying structural problems that have been revealed over the past several years. And I think, you know, I think what we're seeing in this situation is it's like the boy putting his thumb in the dam instead of actually readdressing maybe this is not the right structure to hold in the water. Terrible metaphor, my apologies. But I hope that gets the kind of point across that, like, we have ample examples, and I think you're fully aware of some of them, of some of the abuses and some of the political motivations behind what has happened. And instead of actually having a whole-scale discussion and reevaluation of the record, what we have is you know, some promises from those who are institutionally within the agencies, and you have an effort to punt away the real conversations about really truly addressing those issues. And, you know, I think that's personally where I am. You know, at the same time, I do think it's better now than where we were 5 years ago. But I think you're right. There is this missed opportunity for really look deeper dive into the structural issues that have come to the light and an unwillingness to actually have that debate and discussion.
Okay, this is Nate. We have another caller who would like to ask a question. Let's go to that question now. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Next question.
Hi, this is Marianne McGrail, an attorney in Washington. I thank you both for your interesting comments, and I think probably the most important question that you both raised is the extent to which the judiciary can really assume the responsibilities that the debate would suggest they are to assume. My understanding of the original purpose of the FISA court was it had a very narrow, specific purpose to review requests for special kinds of surveillance. And the debate seems to have expanded that power well beyond the original scope. I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
I would say that one reason it's expanded beyond its scope that I didn't really get to bring up is, you know, is originally the purpose was related to wiretapping, but since then technology has also come so far. And, you know, with some of these requests, it's easy to sweep up a lot of data in that process. So, you know, I think it's expanded in scope for a couple of reasons. First of all, because of the courts and because of the kind of requests that they're getting, but also just because of the nature of the technology is one thing that that I think is, you know, should be kept in mind and should be something, you know, we revisit whenever looking at the purpose of the courts and what exactly the judges can grant and what's, you know, not exactly a judicial exercise.
Yeah, I think Ashley kind of summarized the point pretty well from there, from my end.
Thank you.
Okay, once again, the phone lines are open. If you'd like to ask a question, please do now by hitting star and the pound sign. We'll take a final call for questions. Looks like that may be it for today. I think there's been a great discussion. Ashley, Nathan, are there some parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our audience?
Yeah, I would say, you know, while it's not always top billing, I do think that there has been some incredible reporting on what's been happening in the surveillance space, both from journalists kind of across the space. And I think there's some really interesting blog outlets that have been writing about this for a while, and I think have been really helpful resources. And I also think, well, again, it's not as top of mind as it was probably in summer of 2013 when the Snowden Glenn Greenwald revelations came out. It's still having effect on our lives, and I think it's setting up a important conversations about the proper way of interpretations of the Fourth Amendment and the surveillance kind of infrastructure that exists. And so, you know, please, in the midst of all this coronavirus conversations, and in the midst of all of your working from home opportunities, you know, hopefully you get a chance to kind of deep dive into these discussions and learn more about it. It's been very fascinating. I've really enjoyed having the opportunity to kind of work in this space for several years now.
I agree. I mean, unlike a lot of other areas of policy and law involving technology, there is some really good reporting out there on this, and there's some really good deep dives too on various blogs and also, you know, in mainstream publications as well. It's too bad that a lot of that's been overshadowed recently.
Yeah, and unlike one more thing I'd say is it's also bipartisan. I think that's what's really neat about this conversation is you could walk into the Republican Study Committee, or you could walk into the Progressive Caucus, or you could walk into the Freedom Caucus, or you could walk in to others as well, and you're going to have different conversations from people of generally the same political tribe, have multiple interpretations of how this should play out, and I think that's healthy. I think that's really good when it's not just L versus R, you know, left, right versus, you know, Republican, Democrat, but a real conversation about what's it mean, how should we play out, you know, conservatives and even within the conservative movement, there's so many different interpretations of how this should play. I think that's really encouraging. And I wish more policy issues had that robust and productive conversations.
And it is a bipartisan debate, but I would point out that, you know, a lot of the players on both sides are coming, their concerns come from very different places, whether they're political or they're, you know, worried about the surveillance state. And that's one thing that kind of makes it really hard to get anything done on this issue. And also, you know, there are a lot of moving pieces because of that too, because those concerns change. You know, they're the very different group of people who are concerned about these issues now than they were in 2015, the last time that we had, you know, one of these big debates.
Well, very good. Fascinating topic. Great discussion. Obviously, we'll be watching it very closely. We're grateful to Ashley and Nathan for their time today. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us.
behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.